For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
I'm Michelle Thomas, and welcome to My Shit Therapist, a mental health podcast based on my best-selling, thank you very much, book and audiobook. If you want to hear about medication, meditation, irritations, good and bad coping mechanisms, if you want to chat breakdowns and antidepressants, I've got you. If you're having a bad mental health day, I want to hold your hand through your ears. Are you ready? Good, let's begin. Today, I'm going to be chatting with David Chipakupaku, who is a brilliant young journalist. I met David last year at the Borders Book Festival, where he interviewed me when he was only 19. And I was blown away by how skilled he was, how professional he was. He asked really interesting and astute questions, and I knew then that he was going to go far. And on the day we recorded this episode, he just published his first ever exclusive with Sky News, and he's still only 20. But life hasn't always been easy for David. I want to let you know now that in this episode, we are going to discuss childhood abuse, PTSD, suicide, and his interactions with the police and in psychiatric wards. So if you're not in the right headspace, just come back to this episode another time. Caroline the Cat also pops up in this episode, and David and I chat about Tumblr, 24-hour news, coming out, YouTube rabbit holes, and brilliant British comedy. So I began by asking David the question I ask all my guests, which is, what's the worst and best thing a therapist ever said to you? But then we both got trapped in a nighty-night quote loop because we're both massive Julia Davis fans. I love David. I love this episode. And I really hope you do too.
We've got great comedy in this country.
And like comedy about mental health is in a really interesting space right now in the UK. Flowers was one of the most devastating and brilliant TV shows about how nuanced it was. Even though there's a scene where the son has a giant dick and all his family are laughing at him or something. But that said, like, it's the most nuanced and brilliant depiction of mental health and specifically depression that I've ever seen.
I remember watching it at, I was actually at high school, and just...
All right.
Sorry,
I'm saying it. You're young and beautiful.
Stop it, you. But I just remember being blown away by it. And I just, it was one of those things where, particularly when I was kind of going through teenage depression and just watching Olivia Colman it just kind of made it all kind of feel a bit more normal. I was like, oh my gosh, someone else has gone through this and this is something that I can relate to. And okay, this now all makes sense. Okay, good. I think telly does that for a lot of people, you know. And I think on a similar but slightly different topic, I May Destroy You is giving people a lot of realizations about their own actions and their own past, and kind of like, I have sat there, watched it, and kind of gone through, you know, times that I've been groped in clubs and times that I've been, you know, assaulted, and just being like, oh, that actually happened and that has had an actual impact on my life, and I've not really let it come to the fore. And now that I'm sitting here watching this and watching someone write so eloquently about what that does to your head, okay, all these things now start to make sense. All these kind of actions that I do make sense because Michaela Cole is writing it and putting it on television and I understand it in here. And that's what makes I May Destroy You so good, is that it, like, and I remember she talked about this, I think it was with Front Row or something. Someone asked her, you know, what was it like putting comedy into kind of sexual assault? And she was like, well, there's comedy everywhere. Comedy is like this kind of specter that haunts everything, and it's in everything. It's in death, it's in birth, it's in marriages, it's in divorce, it's in baptisms and fire, and you know, it's everywhere. Comedy doesn't kind of just appear one day and you suddenly start writing something funny about, you know, the time that you were groped in the club, because it's always there. There always can be an element of, you know, of humor, no matter how light or dark it is, in everything, really.
Do you agree? Someone said, I think my English teacher said this to me when I was doing my A-levels. She said, comedy is tragedy played fast.
Yes. Yeah.
And ever since then, that just really stuck with me. And I wonder how it's not as tragedy plus time, I understand, because mm-hmm. you need time to be a bit more objective and gain some perspective on anything. But tragedy played fast. It's that idea that, but I don't, yeah, I love it. There's an interesting thought in there somewhere, but I don't know where it is. I might think of it later and then just like sew it. Stitch it in at this point so that I sound really articulate and witty, because that's the point of my podcast, right? To make me
to make you look good.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
Why else would you do
exactly.
it?
Exactly. I mean, that's what I hear from other white dudes podcasts, so that's what I'm gonna do.
So the worst thing a therapist has ever said to me. Back on topic.
Yeah.
I think the worst thing a therapist has ever said to me, someone who came, they weren't really a therapist, they were more like children's mental health as part of a social work team.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a couple of these people throughout my life, I think four throughout my kind of childhood and teenage years. And the worst one, on the first day that I met him, and just hold on, because you will kind of get really angry at this. The first thing that they said to me was, well, have you tried going for a walk? And that happened every single time that he came around. He said, do you want to go for a walk? How about going for a walk? Have you tried exercise? We could go for a walk. I'm like, yes, I have tried exercise, and that helps for a bit, but it's not going to fix the overall post-traumatic stress disorder that I have. That's not going to be solved by me going for a 40-minute walk around the block. And the other thing that he said to me on the very first day, and again, hold on, because it's really enraging. One of the first things he said was, so did your dad sexually assault you? The first day that I met him, he asked me, like, our kind of getting to know each other questions, so did your dad sexually assault you? And no, my dad did not sexually assault me. Growing up, I didn't have the greatest of childhoods. There were, you know, every childhood has peaks and troughs. My troughs were sometimes lower than other people. And I think that when this person kind of came in to talk to me about my mental health and growing up and things like that, I think, you know, there's a way to ask that. There's a way to ask if a young person has been assaulted. There's a way to ask if something horrible like that has happened. Not on the first day. Not on the, you know, it's like if you go to a restaurant and, you know, I've been on a really intense date before. I don't know how, if you'll ever have experienced this. And you'll sit down and you know, you're having a drink or maybe like having some food, or you're just hanging out by the River Thames or something, and you're just chilling. And then they kind of turn to you and they go, so, you know, have you thought about kids? Or like, have you thought about marriage? Or like, you know, that could happen with us. And I'm like, could it? Sure. Well, at this point in time, I am, let me just check my body clock. At this point, when this date happened, I was like 18 and a half, and I was like, well...
This is not a real thing. This is not a real life example from your life of a thing that happened.
Oh, yeah. And I was just like, well, at this point in my life, I'm 18 and a half, and I have just moved to London, so I don't know about that. let's just pause, rewind, and yeah, let's see what happens.
Was there a second date?
No. Okay. Surprisingly not. So yeah, surprisingly not when you've got someone really intense in your face and just kind of going, so this could like work out. This could be us. No. So going back to that person from social work.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when this person came to see you and to help you? Ostensibly?
Help. Yeah. I think I was 13. Just like having to just have, because when you go through PTSD, it's like your brain is like a really nice batch of boiled baby new potatoes. And suddenly
loving
someone,
wherever
it goes. And you've got these formed memories, you've got these formed solid realistic things have happened. And then when to me in my head, I don't know if this is accurate for what other people have gone through, but when having gone through PTSD, it's like someone's gone, I like those potatoes, but I don't want to put them in a salad. I want to make mash out of them. And it's just got the masher out and just kind of started hammering away at the Le Creuset pot. And it just becomes this kind of like mess of... There are points in there are very, very large blank gaps in my head of what happened in my childhood. And sometimes I remember some things and sometimes I don't remember them. And, you know, my mum will sometimes say, oh, remember when we went to do this? And I go, no. Or, you know, my brothers and sisters will say, oh, do you remember we did that? No. And it's because my body and my head has gone, right, there are really traumatic things that happened in here, and we need to shut that shit down. We need to kind of compact that into a box and put that to one side. But within that box, it's like saying, I'm going to tidy up my living room, and you put the whole living room into the bin. You don't have a living room left. You just got a room and a chair. And that's what it was kind of like in my head. It was like, you had a childhood, but sometimes all I can remember and all I've got is pictures of me growing up and going through different stages of high school. And that's sometimes it's really difficult for me to deal with, because I'm like, I am 20 now, but the first 13... maybe 14 years of my life, there's huge chunks of information missing, and that's kind of what's quite difficult sometimes to deal with.
Mm. How do you talk, or do you talk to your mum and your siblings about your mental health and about those experiences?
Definitely. When I'm talking to my family, I don't want to talk about poor experiences. You know, I talk more to my mum about it, but, you know, the things that she went through, I don't want to upset her. And, you know, my siblings had traumatic childhoods as well, and I don't want to dig that up and be like, so I'm going through something, let's talk about what you went through. This is your life. So I can talk to my family about it, and it's good sometimes just to kind of get things out, but sometimes you just need to kind of pause and just not talk about it and move on. And in some ways that's good.
Yeah.
Because I want to have happy memories with my family. I want to feel like I'm not defined by events and people in my life who have had a negative impact on me, and that, you know, the things that I do with my siblings are not those negative things. Mm. They are positive, happy events. Mm. Yeah.
And that's not the same thing as repressing something and as not wanting to talk about it. That's just saying I don't want to occupy that space all the time.
Yeah, exactly. 100%.
So you've been sort of getting, it doesn't sound like you were getting treatment from this guy, but you've been getting kind of advice and guidance on your mental health since you were about 13. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a while. It's been a long road. Yeah.
When did you start taking medication? If that was a thing.
So I sometimes get my years mixed up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think I started taking medication in 2013. So I was 13 years old, and because I was doing talking therapy, I was doing CBT at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was that age, it was kind of like, so kind of the backdrop to kind of me taking medication, I was starting to use Tumblr a lot. And that was kind of, in some ways, it's a very, very good place.
Mm.
Well, it was back then anyway, to kind of find people who were going through similar situations like you. So I used it a lot when I was kind of struggling with mental health, when I was struggling on coming out, all these different things. It was very kind of affirming in some ways. It's also very, at that point, it was also a very, dark and dangerous place if you knew where to look. When I was in a mental health unit, so I had a couple of stints in mental health units, and I remember talking to fellow patients, and they were like, yeah, there's like pages and pages of pro-anorexia discussion forums, there's all these different like advice as to how to self-harm, there was all these different things. And I think only recently we're kind of starting to take a firm grip of that and trying to take that down. And social media has a lot to, social media is great, and I'll talk more about it, you know, later on, but social media can be great. Social media can also be very, very dark and dangerous and horrible. But going back to medication, what I kind of took away from Tumblr at that point was, for some people, they were going, medication's great. It will solve all your ills. Everything's great. No, that's a lie. That is a lie. Medication is very, very important if you are taking it. And I would obviously say to people, please make sure, if you are taking medication, make sure you are continuing to take your medication. But for me, medication combined with CBT, it was kind of like my head became so woolly, and I just kind of found myself going through the motions of doing life for a little while. It was kind of like my head felt just very fuzzy, and because I was so severely depressed, like I dropped out of various different things that I was doing. I dropped out of Boys Brigade, and I stopped taking part in sport, and I put on a lot of weight that I still would like to quite shift. and it kind of, so I was on fluoxetine at the time, and it just kind of made my head really fuzzy. And then when I was at my second high school, I started taking citalopram for a while, and I think it was about like 50 milligrams a day.
Mm.
And which I don't know whether that's particularly strong or not, but from speaking to other people, it seems like it maybe was. I'm not sure.
I'm on 20. I started on
right.
20, and I'm on 20 now.
So
So for, like quite... for a 13-year-old boy to be on more than double that.
By that time, I might be wrong. It might not have been 50, but as far as I remember, it was 50. And by that time, I was about 15.
Hmm.
So, I just kept, you know, just kept taking it, and it was better for me because I felt it felt clearer, and I was able to, you know, pass my exams and get into college and things like that while on citalopram. And then when I got to college, I just dumped it completely, and which is not advisable. Please don't do it if you are going to do that.
Mm.
But when I got to college, I just I essentially kind of dropped out of the mental health system because I forgot to go to the two appointments I was meant to go to with adult mental health team in Edinburgh, and I stopped taking my medication, and I was fine. Surprisingly, you know, again, always consult your doctor and make sure that you are doing things in a healthy manner.
Mm.
I found that I stopped taking it one day, and I completely forgot to take it, and I was fine. And I guess maybe that was because I was in a different environment and different setting, and I kind of was able to cope better than previously. But
mm.
yeah, medication has had its ups and downs for me.
And how long were you getting talking therapy as well? Or was that a bit more sporadic?
Again, about like 6 years. So 12, 13 until I was... No, hang on. 5 years. 12 or 13 until I was 17.
So quite regularly, kind of weekly or weekly appointments for 5 years. That's quite that's a good big chunk of time. Did it help?
Yeah. Towards the end, I found it very, very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was because by that point, I was a lot more comfortable in my own skin, and I had a clear direction in life. When I was 12, 13, having had my first suicide attempt and kind of like feeling really lost and confused and angry and sad and rage at the world, it was kind of like I felt like I had no purpose whatsoever. I felt really confused and not aligned with anything that was going on around me. By the time I got to like the last couple of sessions, it was kind of like I have a goal, I have purpose.
Mm.
And once you get to that place, it's just so freeing. And it's, you know, obviously mental health continues to be something that I am very mindful of, and particularly mm-hmm. the job that I'm in, I have to be mindful of. But I'm in so much better place than I was when I was a very scared 13-year-old, not really fitting in with anyone. And therapy, sitting down and talking, is part of that.
So what's the best or the most helpful thing that a therapist has said to you?
Last 4 months of therapy that I had when I was a teenager. Was that a cat?
Sorry, that was a really poignant moment and she ruined it.
I love her. Justice for Caroline.
Hashtag justice for Caroline.
So
the last 4 months of your therapy as a teenager.
So the last 4 months of my therapy as a teenager, there were events that happened. I lost a very close friend of mine, and I went very, 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 very numb. The first, like when I found out it happened, I went to bed and I cried a lot. And then I went and I made a loaf of bread, and I just kind of like continued on with life as it was. And the only time that I really remember crying about it afterwards was at the funeral. And when I went to therapy during that time, my therapist was like, you've got this. There's been things that you have had in your life that you've been through that are very, very difficult to deal with. And you're sat here in front of me now, so you can get through this bit in your life and it will pass. Because at that point, I had never had anyone that close to me passing away before. And particularly because it was 4 months before I was due to leave school and I had my exams coming up. And yeah, I went kind of numb. Like my English teacher had to pull me to one side and be like, so at the time I was, my advanced higher English books were going to be Wuthering Heights, Jane Eyre, and a book called The Virgin Suicides, which is this really, it's fantastic and I love it. It's really jaw-dropping in the way that it's written. People who are listening who remember the movie version, which I haven't seen, I just read the book. And it's horrible. It's a horrible book, but it's fantastic. And again, it's incredibly tragic, but there are elements of humor in it. But my English teacher had to pull me to one side and be like, David, you're doing this book about five teenage girls who all kill themselves. And sorry, a motorbike just went past the flat.
Motorbike.
Very, very rude motorbike. That's my equivalent of Caroline.
At least your motorbike doesn't shit next to you.
I love it when they do that. My English teacher, Alistair, took me to one side and was like, you're doing a book about five teenagers who kill themselves and, you know, your friend has just taken his own life. And at that point, I was like, am I doing something wrong? Is there something very much wrong with me? And my therapist was like, you know, you're just processing it in the way that you are processing it. And that's, you know, if you just bury yourself in work, then that's okay, as long as you kind of come up for air at some point and take a breather. And I think that at the funeral, that's when I took a breather and I kind of took it all in and really appreciated what kind of was going on. So, but just having that moment where, you know, my therapist just looked me directly in the eye and she was like, you have got this, it is going to be okay. That was really affirming. And yeah, it is one of the best things that a therapist has said to me.
But it sounds like that came at the end of, you know, if she'd said that to you kind of 2 years before or at any different point in your life, do you think you would have felt as affirmed by it? Or do you think that the groundwork that had been put into your own growth and your own development, that all helped as well?
Definitely. I think, yeah, if it had come at any other point, I'd have just been like, and it had come at other points where people kind of saying, you know, you're doing really great, you can do this, you've got this. And I was just like, oh, piss off, mm-hmm. You know? Mm. Just particularly like all of the, because of the things I'd experienced, and it felt like at some point it was kind of like one thing after another, mm. Particularly my mental health was so poor. So I kind of had got used to like a pattern of something awful is going to come around the corner, which I have just realized now that is maybe why I was so awfully depressed for so long, is because I was being abused and then I was being bullied at school and then I was attempting to take my own life and then I was in hospital. And then I had, you know, poor experiences with the police. And then I was in hospital again. And then everything kept coming. And I think maybe if I'd been in the midst of that, I just would have gone, piss off, because it's just kind of like, I keep going through all these horrible things. When is something good going to happen?
Mm.
And now we're in a position where good is happening and I can see it happening. And that kind of makes, I guess, all the difference, really.
Mm. What does you've mentioned that you look after your mental health and you're mindful of it now. What does that mean? What practical steps does that involve? So if you can, is it that you maybe see, right, I'm going to be really busy for the next 6 weeks. I'm not going to get a day off. I need to plan X, Y, and Z. Or is it a bit more like I can feel something coming. I can feel a cloud coming and this is what I'm going to do to put the brakes on it.
My boobs are really sensitive. They can tell the weather. But on a more serious note, no, I can kind of tell when something is coming its way, and I I've just got the picture of her just standing and doing the weather report for that local news channel and kind of going, it's raining, my boobs can feel it. Yeah.
Mental health things, self-care,
storm warning. Yeah, self-care,
storm warning.
So I can kind of tell when, oh, she's beautiful, isn't she? I can tell when something is coming, and I can kind of feel it in the feel it in the back of my head of just like, okay, I need to be aware that, you know, next couple of days are going to be not great. I've realized over the last 2 years of doing this apprenticeship is that I love to work, and I love kind of throwing myself at projects and kind of getting involved. And sometimes that's really great. And you get really good work out of it. Sometimes when you are struggling with your mental health, it then becomes more frustrating and more anxiety inducing and more, you get more impatient. And that can be tricky as well. And I think one of the things about working in news is we don't know what's coming around the corner. And we have really great safeguards at work to make sure that, you know, my office is very aware of, like, working in 24/7 news. 21st century. 24/7 news. working in 21st century news, you need to be aware of the kind of the factors around you and how that can have an impact on your mental health. And so we have people in the office who are trained mental health first aiders and are there constantly just to kind of, you know, you will write an email to them, go for a coffee. It's a bit more tricky when, you know, we're all stuck at home at the moment, but you can have a Teams meeting and just sit and chat or do like we're doing just now. And that's really helpful and really useful, particularly when, you know, you've got stuff that is relevant to you. Sorry, I'm going off on a bit on a tangent. Self-care.
Go for it.
Because news is kind of ever-changing, you never know what's going to come around the corner. It can be a bit hard to predict how that's going to affect your mental health. I remember one of the days I remember at work, people say to me, like, what's the day you remember it? You know, I actually asked that of Simon Mayo at Borders Book Festival when I was about 13. I went up to him and I was like, what day do you remember working in the newsroom? And he was live on 5 Live when the planes crashed into the Twin Towers. And I was like, wow, that is something, you know, a moment in history, really. I never thought I would be in a similar situation. Fast forward to 2018, you know, it was last year. And the Christchurch shooting, and having to come in on that day, having watched it from home at like 7 in the morning and being on the bus and just being like, okay, so this is what I'm going to have to deal with today. Particularly because at that point, my job was putting content out onto on-demand platforms, so people were watching things on YouTube and Xbox and the app that we have on television for Apple TV and Roku and all these different gadgets and gizmos. And I'm like, this is how some people are going to digest this today. This is how some people are going to deal with this today. And I saw stuff that I never want to see again. And like the unredacted video of that shooter going in and just like having to pause and just like deal with all the things that were going on in my head afterwards. It was just kind of like, how can someone be so harmful and how can someone do that to someone else? And then like, you know, you don't mean to relate it to what you've gone through, but then you're like, I have had someone who was harmful to me, and oh my gosh, remember this happening, remember all this, blah, 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 blah. And then suddenly it's just incredibly overwhelming. It all comes from this one place of thousands and thousands of miles away, someone doing something disgusting and horrible. And that when you're in a newsroom, that beams straight into your eyeballs, and it's your job to kind of stop other people from seeing it in some ways, you know. It's someone's job in our newsroom to blow the picture of the body. It's someone's job in a newsroom to disguise, you know, the voice of an assault victim. It's someone's job to, you know, have to talk to the parents of a murdered child. You know, it's, and I'm very, very grateful that we have things in place, but it is always, you know, you come in and you never really know what you're going to have to face that day. Digital world, we live in a world where there is endless information and it never stops. And for me, having been on Twitter for almost 10 years now, I have to put my phone away. I have to make sure that I don't get home at 9:30 and go, oh, you know what, I'll do in 1:15, I'll watch Newsnight. Oh, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to watch the 10 o'clock news from Us. You know, I'm going to watch Press Preview and watch people get angry. I have to pause and just go, no. And that's very difficult to do sometimes, particularly when you're someone like me, where I've got to kind of, I feel like I have to know everything about what's going on in the world. And part of that is because it's my job to know what's happening. And, you know, I'm very lucky that I'm living in a newsroom and I work in a newsroom, which goes, you can pause and stop and take a little bit of a break before coming back and doing things again. So, yeah, self-care is vital, kind of, not just for, it's more vital for me now than ever before, really, because of what I do.
And what does self-care look like? What does, like, when you just come home and just want to unplug and just forget and not think about the news and not think about your job, what do you do?
I find comfort in comedy. I find comfort in music. I'm a huge music buff. Like still in the back of my head, my dream job is to host the Radio 1 Breakfast Show. Even though what I do right now is very, very serious and very, very direct, and what, you know, providing news in the back of my head, one day maybe
visualize it,
put it out into the world.
It's yours. Claim it. Law of attraction.
And I'm a huge fan of music. I love sharing music. I love finding new artists and new bands. And that's something that I like to do when I'm trying to put things to one side. I kind of go, well, let's go down the YouTube rabbit hole of, well, I like this artist. Let me type in Charlie XCX. Watch some Charlie XCX videos. Oh, who's this person? Oh, this person's called Dorian Electra. Let me find out about Dorian Electra and listen to some Dorian Electra. This person's called Umru. Let me listen to Umru and see what happens when I listen to Umru. Oh my gosh, this is so wild. Those are all real artists that I have found through doing rabbit holes of YouTube and rabbit holes of Spotify. What I like about it is it feels like my brain is processing. That's what I'm like, this is what the inside of my head sounds like, and I can hear it. And it's wild.
David Chipakupaku. Oh God, I've got so many things I want to ask you about. I want to ask you about going into hospital, like we haven't really covered that. And was that residential?
Yeah. So it was, I did three stints in hospital.
In your teens, so between 13 and 16.
Mm-hmm. So 2013 was my first one. No, well, the first two were in 2013. First time round was in kind of spring, and it was about a week, and I don't remember very much of it. The second time was October 2013 to January 2014, and I was in hospital for, I was allowed out for Christmas, but I was in, my mental health got so bad, I was in for Christmas, for New Year's Day and New Year's Eve. And that period of time was really, really difficult because I was missing out on a lot of key stuff that was happening around me. So, for example, that year, a lot of my friends at school took part in, like I could see things happening around me, and I was just kind of like, I should be getting involved with this and I can't because I'm stuck here. Like, my friends took part in the Children Need Choir that year. I missed going, like, a New Year's party with my family because I was in hospital. And it was just, it was a very intense time as well. Other big things that happened that were, like, were important to me was I was in hospital on the day of the 50th Doctor Who anniversary. And that was something that, like, as a young teenager, I was kind of like, I want to be with friends and kind of like celebrating that and, you know, doing that by myself. And I couldn't. And I think it was a really difficult time to kind of be in a hospital environment, because I think 13 to 14, and you know, you talk a lot about kind of preteens and getting to 16 and going, like, you know, getting all these freedoms at 16. But I think 12 to 15 is kind of like a really key time, because you're making so much knowledge is gathered at that point. Lots of emotional experiences, and you're kind of finding things for the first time. So in that age bracket, during that time, I kind of found, not just in hospital, but like outside of hospital as well, I was finding my first, like, bands and musicians that I found by myself and without the help of other people, or, you know, the radio or things like that. I was kind of like finding people that on my own, and, you know, you start choosing books that you want to read, and you start becoming a person, essentially. And for me, a lot of that was stunted by my mental health and having been in a hospital environment. And it was difficult. So the second time around that I was there was really difficult, because a lot of the time, patients had to kind of, we were looking after ourselves, because there were some people who were very, very ill and needed more attention from staff. Often we kind of, like, for those of us who weren't in that position, we kind of gathered together and celebrated things that were happening ourselves. Like, so if one of the people who had an eating disorder ate a meal, then we kind of, like, celebrated that together. And if, you know, we kind of had jokes together, and we kind of, like, tried to pull each other through. And then sometimes, like, staff impacted on that. There was one time where we made an innuendo about someone, like, eating a banana. And it was like me and these two girls, both who had eating disorders. And the three of us kind of, like, one of the girls, Jo, she said, "Oh, I had a banana today." And we kind of, like, had a laugh. We were like, "Huh," because, you know, we're teenagers. And one of the, like, a staff member came up to me and this other girl who was there and kind of really reprimanded us, and she was like, how dare you, like, you know, what you were doing was really disgusting and horrible. And we were like, what have we done? And we were like, she said, you were laughing at someone with an eating disorder, and they were eating something, and that's really good. And we were like, no, we were having a laugh, we were joking together. No, that's really disgusting what you did. Can you please go to your room? So like, what you've done is really horrible and detrimental to the impact of mental health of other people. And this girl was kind of going, no, it was a joke, we were having a laugh. And the other big things that happened was, you know, there was when my mental health further deteriorated, it kind of wasn't really taken seriously almost. I had a point where I started seeing things. I started seeing, one of the other patients who was, I knew was in the room next door. But I saw her outside wandering around in like this red dress outside in the garden area. I remember hearing people screaming outside. And when I went and said, you know, something's wrong, this keeps happening, they were like, no, that's not what your illness is. Because I was in having had like suicide attempts and I was depressed and had PTSD. So it's like, no, that's not related to your illness. And I was like, well, that's what I'm experiencing. It felt very, the whole time was very, it stripped back a lot of my freedoms. I had to in some ways, I had to hand my phone in when I went to bed. But then, you know, sometimes it was really difficult because it got to the point where some freedoms were kind of taken away from me in a really terrifying way. Like there were evenings where, because I was so depressed and so suicidal, people had to watch me sleep. Like people had to sit in the room with the door open and watch me fall asleep. And that was horrifying. Whenever, like, you know, it's bizarre. I had members of staff who were working on the social work kind of side. I had someone who said that I had told other patients how to harm themselves and how to take their own lives. And everyone on the ward went up to him and said, no, that's not true. That's not what's happened here. The person who was working on the social work team, he convinced other people that I had done that. And, you know, hearing as a 13-year-old going into 14, having been pulled to one side and being reprimanded and being told that you have caused damage to other people's mental health when you clearly have not, is really, you know, particularly I'm incredibly empathetic and I take on emotions from other people.
Mm.
And like the last thing I ever want to do to anyone is upset them, hurt them, whether that be physically, emotionally, mentally. And that, like, the idea to me of hurting someone in any sort of way is the most horrifying thing I can think of. And but that, all that kind of happened in my second stint in hospital. And then the third time that I went was in October of 2014, and I had just tried to take my own life. And I was in that hospital for about a week. And it was really, that time around, it was really, really miserable. Like other previous times, I had had things that were good and that were light, and, you know, that some bits were, dare I say, enjoyable, like being able to kind of switch off from everything that was happening around me and just sit on an Xbox for a couple of hours was some ways very therapeutic. But that time around, in October 2014, it was incredibly, incredibly harmful. So by that point, I had just tried to take my own life, but previously I'd also been essentially off-rolled from my school. So there was a night where I left home to try and take my own life. And I eventually, I sobered up and I was like, okay, this is not sensible. And when I was a younger teenager, there was a police marker on my house. So if my mum phoned 999 and said, my son's gone missing, then because it was Hoika, there was nothing else to do. Essentially, every police officer would come to find me. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to walk to the police station, because that seems like the most sensible thing to do, because I know they'll be looking for me. I walked in, I gave my name to the desk, and I sat down and clearly remember the police officers in the next room saying, oh, here's the kid that's wasted police time. Here's the kid that has, this is such a waste of people's time. Like, what's he doing? And I was being taken home by an officer who I later met, and we'll come on to that incident with the police. But she said to me, why did you do what you did tonight? And I said, well, have you ever wanted to take your own life? And she said, and I quote, no, but we deal with your sorts of people all the time. And I just remember being incredibly angry at having been described like that. And I got home, I went to my room, and my mum came up to see me, and she was like, you know, is everything okay? What can I do? And I was just like, I want everything to go away. I want the house to burn down. I want the school to burn down. I want just everything to go away. I just want it all to stop. And my mum went downstairs to the police, and they were like, you know, is everything all right? And he was like, and she was like, oh, he was just saying things about wanting the school to burn down. And, you know, just, he's just not very well right now. He just needs a bit of time. We got a phone call the next day from the school to say, David cannot come in because he's a high risk to other students. He's a risk to other people. And hearing that was devastating, because for me, learning and school was a lifeline. It was a lifeline out of my own head. It was a lifeline out of my house. And I had never had any sort of trouble previously with school. I'd had, up to that point, a lot of support, actually. And yeah, being told I'm like some sort of monster and I'm going to harm other people when I've never laid a finger on anyone else's, you know, was really difficult. And it just kind of sent me into this spiral, because I was told you can only come in for 2 lessons a week. And I was allowed to pick what those were. And I was allowed to come in for music, and I was allowed to come in for social studies, so politics, the world, essentially. And so I just eventually just kept spiraling, and I tried to take my own life again, and I ended up in hospital this third time round. And, you know, it was miles away from home, so that was another thing that was really difficult. And I don't really remember very much of it, but my mum essentially broke me out of it and discharged me herself, because she was like, you're not taking good enough care of my son, I'm not having it. And I'm incredibly grateful for her doing that, because as far as I remember, I don't know very much, I don't remember very much of it, but I just was having a horrible time. And my mum and my grandmother as well were just kind of like, this is not the place for you. And I got taken out. And so I know that for many people, hospital is an experience that they take in and is very beneficial for them. For me, it was something I never want to go through again. I never, hopefully never will have to go through again, because it just, it was more harm than good, really. And I met people that I'm still in contact with today, and, you know, I'm grateful for that. But on the whole, it just, nah.
Mm. All right, 3 more questions. One.
Don't pick up the phone, you know,
oh, I love Charlie XX. No, I know that was Dua Lipa. I knew sure. That was Dua Lipa. Sure. I was doing a joke.
Sure, she knew.
I knew. I'd be knowing. So you said that, just something that you said when you were hospitalised for that second time, when you were 13, 14. And you felt like you were missing out on joining the Children in Need choir and the Doctor Who anniversary. And I can tell that you felt that you said that you felt stunted by that. Do you think that's something that's fueled your drive now? Because are you 20 now?
Yeah.
You're 20, you've moved from the Scottish borders to London, you've done an apprenticeship with Sky News, you have hosted panels at international book festivals, you're the most accomplished 20-year-old I've ever met, and I don't mean that in a patronising way, I just adding up all the stuff that you've done very like objectively and clearly, you're a very accomplished person. Do you think you are driven by that? Do you feel like you're playing catch up?
In some ways I feel like I'm playing catch up. In other ways I feel like I just went, okay, let's just grow the hell up now and deal with it. I think when I got to 13 and I was like, okay, so what I want to do once this hellscape is over is work in media and be on the radio and do all these different things and maybe work in journalism. That's an idea. And so I started off by applying to my local radio station, Radio Borders, to, they had at the time a young people's show that was partly financed by the council, that was by and for young people. It was an hour every Sunday of music and chat and local events and things that were happening. And I was like, okay, I'm determined to do that and go and do it. So over my Easter and summer holidays, I would just kind of do weeks and weeks at a time where unpaid, I would just kind of go in and, you know, mess around in the studio. And I was asked to edit the farming program that went out every morning. I was kind of like asked to, you know, help out. I was asked to drive the desk at one point during drive time, which was absolutely terrifying. And I was like 14. And so I just kind of said to myself, you know, you've missed out on all these things that normal kids are doing. Why not just go ahead and do what adults are doing? Why not just make it happen now? And I don't really regret that. In some ways, like I do feel like I missed out on doing the things that normal teenagers do. Like I look particularly at my brothers and sisters, and in some ways I'm very, very jealous because they did things that normal teenagers do. Like I love my sister so much, my sister Violet, and she has just kind of, she's so talented, like it's kind of annoying. And she kind of had a bit more of a bit more normal teenage experience, like, you know, going out and staying at one high school and having you know, a group of girls around her and friends and, you know, the kind of typical teenage drama stuff. Whereas, you know, I was doing things really differently, and I didn't, when I came home at weekends from my second school, because it was a boarding school, that, you know, essentially because the council said, well, we can't have you in one of our regular schools, so we'll pay for you to go to this special school up in Perthshire, that, you know, because I was coming home and I didn't really want to relate to people from who were from my original high school, I was coming home and then I would watch TV and write things for my blog, and then I would go, you know, on Sunday evening, I would go back up to school. And then when I got to 16, I would come home, work on Saturday at a cafe, come home, do bits and pieces, and then go back up. And I kind of never really paused to kind of have that kind of those teenage drama and teenage experiences. I remember once when I was 16, my sister encouraged me to come to a house party that was happening at a friend's place. And it was so not normal for me, because there were people that at my old school, who were from my old school, that I was like, I don't want to really talk to them. And I just drank quite a lot and accidentally came out that evening. And that, and then, you know, but my, you know, other people my age were doing those types of things quite regularly, and were going to house parties and having girlfriends and boyfriends and partners and, you know, doing all these things. So in some ways I very much do regret, like, not having that period almost of just making mistakes and going through things. On the other hand, you know, I'm never one of these people that likes to kind of go, yeah, I'm 20 and I do these great things. But then, like, sometimes I do go, like, yeah, I have done quite great things. I'm not particularly very, very old. Like, on the day that we're recording this, I just put out my first ever exclusive, and I'm 20 on a national broadcaster.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm 20. And that terrifies me sometimes, because I'm like, if I'm doing this now, what happens in 5 years' time? Like, 5 years ago, I was a severely depressed teenager, you know, barely able to function. And now I'm here. And I just kind of, it worries me sometimes in a kind of weird way that I'm like, oh Lord, what's going to happen in what's going to happen in 2025? Where am I going to be then? And
you're going to be the host of the Radio 1 breakfast show.
Who knows? I'll say what.
Grimy. Is that right?
Grimy. Yeah. Grimy.
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah.
I know people.
He's not been breakfast show presenter for 2 years now, but
I'm up to date. I know things.
Do you know who Greg James is?
Is he the man who is in The Inbetweeners? No, that's Greg Davis.
That's Greg Davis.
If someone asks you for advice, if a young person in particular asks you for advice on dealing with their mental health, what would you say?
Try and find someone who is, you know, that person that you can turn to, that you can text or call or, you know, do whatever you do to kind of to let them know how you're feeling and talk through those emotions that you've got and the things that are going through your head, because it's normal that you can relate that to. And I think that's the first step with all of it, is just being able to talk and being able to discuss what's going on inside your own brain, which is very difficult to do sometimes when you're not feeling it. And so the other piece of advice is, if you find talking difficult, find a medium that you can express yourself in, so people can kind of get a better idea of what's going on in your head, because you shouldn't suffer in silence. You shouldn't have to deal with things yourself. And so the best way out of that, and the best way to kind of let people in, is doing it in a medium that suits you. And that can be, for lots of people, that's talking. For other people, that's writing things down. For some people, it's creating art or music to kind of express what's going on. And then kind of drawing a conversation up from that. You know, to find the thing that is able to express what's going on. Because to have the best mental health, really, that you can, you need to let people in. You need to let people understand what's going on.
That was lovely. Thank you.
Do try.
Thank you so much. I know, like, I know that you're really busy, and I so massively appreciate you chatting to me.
Thank you for inviting me to chat to you. It's lovely talking to you.
David Chipakupaku is a journalist, and you can find him on Twitter at David_Chippa, C-H-I-P-P-A. Such a brilliant young man. Please share this episode with anyone you think needs to hear it. You can follow me on Twitter at MyShitTherapist. Special thanks to producer Albert Davis and to Jack Duff for the music. And thank you so much for listening. Until next time, take care and take your meds.